This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and use the promotional code War Rocket Ajax to get $3 off a brand new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that War Rocket Ajax to bring back his body?
Welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always, my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, I always ask you how you're doing tonight, which is weird because people don't have to listen to this at night. They can listen to it at any time.
The question is, how am I doing any time of the day?
Matt, how are you in perpetuity?
I'm a little sniffly.
Okay, you're not getting sick, are you?
I hope not. I hope this is gone by the time we are in the same place, because I'm coming to visit you this weekend.
That's a weird thing about this episode, is that we are, right now as we're talking, not in the same place. And then when people are hearing this, we will not be in the same place, but we will basically be hanging out for the entire time in between.
That's right. We'll just be talking about, we'll be together wringing our hands laughing about how we duped all the rubes with our fake personas on War Rocket Ajax.
That's a little more aggressive than I was just thinking. It was a little weird.
Chris, how are you tonight? Are you okay? Or at any time of the day?
I'm doing all right. I'm tired. Because, well, I guess I'll get to it in checks. Here's a preview of this hot episode we've got coming up. I did Zumba yesterday.
You and I have had a conversation about whether you did Zumba in Zubaz.
And, no, I did not.
It did not happen, but maybe it can in the future. Before we get to any of that, though, we have to announce who our guest is, and we are very excited to have him on the show yet again. He is always super fun to talk to. Fred Van Lente is going to be on the show. Once we get to our interview segment, he's going to be talking about his new Valiant Comics series, Generation Zero, at least nominally he will be.
Yeah, you're also going to get a story of a celebrity encounter that I am going to go ahead and say right up front, we have no firsthand knowledge of, and so it is alleged. Yes. Everything that happens is alleged.
That's right. Put a reportedly in front of everything, okay? We are not getting any kind of libel up in this piece. Fred's going to be coming on the show. He's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get to that check you just teased, Chris, before we get to talking to Fred, we've got some business to take care of, including talking about our Patreon just a little bit.
That's right, Matt. Now, as people who listen to the show well know by this point, if you like the show and you feel like it's worth supporting monetarily, you can head over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kick in as little as a dollar a month to help me and Matt keep the lights on, pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills, deal with my rent increase. That would be swell of you. So do we have any new Patreon backers to thank this week, Matt?
We have one new Patreon supporter, Terry Carruthers.
Ah, thank you, Terry.
If you would like to help us out a little bit, help us keep the show going, get special stuff that only patrons get, such as ad-free episodes of the show, bonus audio, special backer-exclusive art, and other fun items, you can go to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kick in what you can. If you can't kick in anything, the show will continue to show up on iTunes as it always does, and it's on Google Play now too. If you're on Google Play, you can go check us out there. But if you want to get a few extras, then send us a little on Patreon, and we'll hook you up. All right, Chris, let's do our checks and recs.
Let's do it.
Chris, we got a little sneak peek about your Zumba expedition. What's going on with that?
Well, Matt, I'm checking in this week to let you know that I've had a very eventful first week in my new home. First, I want to give a shout out to the surprising number of War Rocket Ajax listeners that we have in the triangle. A couple people have offered to, like, hey, if you've got any questions about, like, good places to hang out or good places to eat, they've reached out to me with that. There have been people who have, one, a person messaged us over Patreon and offered me a place to stay in Cary, if I needed it while I was waiting on the apartment. So if that was you, just email me, because I want to say thanks for that. That was awesome of you. A lot of friendly people, and that friendliness extends to not just listeners of the show, but, like, everyone I've met, which is weird. Because people in my old town were often just, you know, openly hostile for no reason. I've done a lot this week. I did Zumba, because I have yet to find a new martial arts school, and so I'm trying to keep my cardio up, and the apartment complex offers free Zumba classes on Wednesday. So I did some Latin-inspired dance aerobics yesterday. It was very difficult. I am a gentleman of carriage. And so moving around for an hour is very hard for me. I was literally as sweaty at the end of that as I was doing MMA.
There are Zumba video games that you can get for Xbox. It's like this Kinect-based Zumba game where, like, it shows you the dance moves and then you're supposed to do them, like, in a workout. And so Marlene and I bought one of those Zumba games and we were going to play it. The problem was that our living room was not big enough to actually use the Kinect and get it to – the image could not be our whole body, so it would cut off our feet, which would already made it an uphill climb. And then the game just penalizes you mercilessly for missing a move at all. Like, if you don't get your knee up just enough – on that move. So we reached the level of fuck it with this Zumba game really quickly. I'm glad to hear you got an in-person class, which I'm sure is much better.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying this mental image of you and Marlene just, you know, angrily Zumba-ing at your Kinect. That's fantastic. I went to we're now members of the local co-op. Which was awesome because we got all kinds of local stuff. Like, we've had local meat, we've had local milk, which is amazing. If you've never had, like, local whole milk, it's rad. So much local stuff, so much local produce. Also, Matt, y'all been to Costco? Costco is great.
We have been to there's not a Costco in Asheville, but we have been to Costco before, yeah.
Matt, I went to Costco. It's my first time going to Costco. Aiden's been before because there's one in Minneapolis. But we went to Costco, Matt. How many Rice Krispie treats do you think we came home with? Just see if you can guess.
50.
You're so close. It was 54. 54 Rice Krispie treats.
I saw the photo where you had a bunch of Rice Krispie treats and also, like, a huge thing of Hello Panda, which was fantastic.
Yeah, now we have, I think I ate two packs of the Hello Pandas, which are delicious. Well, if you want a quick, like, off-mic snack situation, I will tell you right now, we went to Costco 6 days ago. We have zero of the 54 Rice Krispie treats left, which I believe is 9 Rice Krispie treats a day average.
I'm glad your city live-in experience is going well so far.
I'm very excited, and I'm excited about you coming to visit and kind of showing you places. I'm excited about, like, you know, like, hearing from people who listen to the show and want to, like, show me places around here. So far, it's really fun to live here. Matt, what's your check this week?
My check is something I did on a whim that is on the cusp of being the dumbest thing I've ever done, internet comedy wise.
This was going to be my rec.
Was it really?
I was gonna mention it.
Well, we can make it a mutual check and rec. I saw that Werner Herzog, the director, was on the WTF podcast with Marc Maron, and listeners of this show probably know that I have a weird relationship with the WTF podcast and with Marc Maron as a comedy figure. So the notion of Werner Herzog, who is another figure that I have a fascination with and that I try to do an impression of, the confluence of those two things was inspirational to me. So I sat down with my microphone and I recorded about 7 minutes, almost 7 minutes, of me talking as Werner Herzog under the pretense that he has been inspired by Marc Maron to start a podcast. So this is the idea is that this is the first episode of his podcast. I recorded this. I tried to figure out, okay, well, where can I put this? Because you can't just post an audio file on Twitter. And I didn't want to like do one of those like, I guess I could have done like SoundCloud or something, but I figured the best thing to do would just be YouTube. So I found a public domain, or at least a Creative Commons photo of Werner Herzog. I desaturated it a little bit in Photoshop. I put a logo on it for the title I came up with for his podcast. And then I just posted it on YouTube. And so now on YouTube, this video, which is just a still image with audio over it, where I'm talking as Werner Herzog doing the first episode of his podcast, it's available on YouTube now. I'll put a link in the show notes. I think it has maybe like a little over 100 views at the moment. I wasn't expecting anybody to actually pay attention to it or watch it or care about it. It just was something to amuse myself. And it's not like I don't have plenty of things to do already. I'm finishing the first draft of this fucking book I have to write. But I decided to do this dumb Werner Herzog, extended Werner Herzog impression. So I hope somebody thought it was funny and somebody got a kick out of it. If you want to check it out, I will put it in the show notes.
My actual recommendation this week is going to be a birthday present that I received over the past few days. Benito Sereno, who is also celebrating a recent birthday, you know, friend of the show, sent me a book that I'm really excited to read. I'm only about 40 pages into it, 51 pages exactly into it. And it is called The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar, by Greg Klein. According to Benito, he heard an interview with the author and was like, well, that's what Chris is getting for his birthday. He had it. He got it. This is exactly my kind of thing, an in-depth history of the Junkyard Dog. Now, Matt, are you like super familiar with old JYD?
I have some familiarity with his history based on the chapter about him in The Squared Circle, David Shoemaker's book, and just like seeing some like archival stuff of when, you know, he was in Memphis or whatever. But I don't have a huge, like, you know, he predates when I would have been a fan, except for his WWF run, which is kind of a weird late career thing for him.
He came to prominence in like the late 70s, early 80s. And I think you and I kind of got into wrestling specifically through WCW in the late 80s, and then on through the 90s. So, you know, he's one of those guys that I always hear about, but I kind of completely missed out on. And so far, those are always the wrestlers that I'm most fascinated by in a way, like these guys who were like huge stars that I have no actual connection to, but that resonated with so many people. There's an introduction and a preface. There's a prologue and an introduction before you get to chapter one. And the introduction kind of takes you through the brief version of the entire story of you know, his life and then later decline and into his death in the late 90s. But the prologue is about Greg Klein going to New Orleans and just walking down the street asking people if they remember him. And I think that's a really, really cool way to open the book and a really cool way to set the stage and kind of characterize how important he was in the history of pro wrestling. So I'm really enjoying it. It's actually from the same publisher as the print version of The Death of WCW. So I don't know if they publish things that are not wrestling books, but so far 100% of their output that I have and that you have are all about pro wrestling histories. So I'm really looking forward to getting deeper into it and reading it. I'm into the chapter that really kind of goes through the history of Cowboy Bill Watts and why he was sort of motivated to put a black wrestler at the top of the card in the South in the late 70s. So it's really interesting, and I'm really enjoying it. I'll give you an update once I'm done reading it, but I think it's going to hold up as a solid recommendation. So thanks to Benito for that.
Yeah, Cowboy Bill Watts, not known as one of wrestling's great progressives.
No, not at all.
The idea that he did that, I mean, the obvious thing is that he had to see money in JYD.
Oh, so. Yeah. I mean, like, in the introduction to the book, there's this, you know, a conversation between Bill Watts and two of his partners that he was in business with in Mid-South. And one of them was a blind racist, which is always a fun thing to have. And, you know, he was, like, after they did their first Superdome show that was main evented by two black wrestlers, he was, you know, very disparaging about the racial makeup of the crowd. And one of the other guys just goes, yeah, well, the money's green, so that's the only color that matters to me. Matt, what's your recommendation this week?
My recommendation, I'll get there, but let me tell a little story first. I was walking around in downtown Asheville, actually today, the day that we're recording this, and just kind of putting around in downtown Asheville, and I came across it may have been there for a while, but it seemed fairly new to me. It's a new soda and candy shop called Rocket Fizz, which is apparently a big chain of soda pop and candy shops that is national. So there is very much a possibility that there's one in your town. Chris, there's not one in Durham, but there's one in Raleigh.
Ooh, okay.
And they have a pretty big selection of candy, which is great. But I obviously, based on my history, was interested in going in there and looking at kind of what their soda selection was. They make their own sodas, apparently. And then they have a pretty wide selection of kind of maybe hard-to-find or regional sodas. So it's one of those shops where, like, they try to get in regional or craft soda and sell it nationally, even outside of the areas where it's normally available, like in supermarkets. Like, Cheerwine is available there. And there was a store like that in Chicago that I occasionally would go to and be able to find Cheerwine, which was kind of the only place that had it. So while I was in there, I decided that I was going to look for one of my favorite sodas from the Midwest that I haven't seen elsewhere. I believe it's actually a Wisconsin thing. But it's a soda called Sprecher, which I think is actually made by a beer brewer. But they also make these craft sodas. And there are several different kinds of Sprecher soda. There's like an orange cream. There's a root beer. There's maybe a ginger beer or a ginger ale. But the one that I always liked was their cherry cola, which I would say is easily the best cherry cola I've ever had. Kind of by a long shot. And that even includes, like, you know, if you go to Waffle House or to some restaurant where they put in, you know, the cherry syrup there, and it's kind of like a little fresher than like the pre-mixed, you know, cherry Coke or cherry Pepsi or whatever. And I did find the Sprecher cherry cola at Rocket Fizz. I immediately bought it, even though it was like $2.25 for a 16-ounce bottle. And I got to pop the top off with a little can or a bottle opener they had there. And I just walked around. I drank that bottle of soda as I was walking around in downtown Asheville today. And boy, it really hit the spot. And if you have one of those like craft soda stores somewhere around you and you're like, I would love to get one of these like regional sodas, but I don't know what to get, look for Sprecher cherry cola. Because that shit is good.
I understand your reluctance at paying $2.25. I've talked before about how I went to the fancy restaurant Husk in Charleston and cheer wine was like $3 a glass. I went to Kroger today and they were said like cheer wine was on special. Three 2 liter bottles for $5.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the cheer wine, I will say the cheer wine that you get at the grocery store, I think they use a slightly different formula from the cheer wine that they put in the glass bottles and ship all around the country. I think that's more like a craft cheer wine with like cane sugar. But nonetheless, cheer wine's cheap if you live where you can get it.
Yes. It's why I can never truly leave the South.
All right, Chris. Those are our checks and recs. Let's talk about some of the comics that came out this week.
Yeah, let's do it.
Chris, you want to kick it off with Batman number 5, which concludes the first arc of the Tom King, David Finch run on Batman?
Yeah, and I think we should kick it off by saying that you called it, Matt. Like, you had this one pegged from day one.
But you mentioned this to me, and I feel like it was telegraphed at least a little bit for several reasons. One is, I feel like Gotham, like between Gotham and Gotham Girl, like if one of them had to go, it wasn't going to be Gotham Girl, right? Likewise, right. You can't have a character in Batman whose name is just Gotham. It was confusing enough after just 5 issues. And then actually, like this issue actually like pulls into distinct focus the interchangeability of Gotham the guy and Gotham the city and then Batman as a representation of Gotham. So there's a whole conversation where at first you don't know if they're talking about the city, the guy, or Batman, and then it starts becoming this literal thing where it's like Batman's like, I'm Gotham. If you're going to destroy Gotham, you got to destroy me.
Like there's literally a panel where Batman says to Gotham the guy, you want to kill Gotham? And it's and like it stopped me. And I will say, huge fan of Tom King. But that is a kind of line that just stopped me. And like I had to step out of the story for a minute and kind of figure out the context of everything. But yeah, it gets a little weird here in the last act.
It's a weird story, but it's also, I don't know, risk taking. It's a different kind of Batman story, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean the flip side to that is that comes right after a page that I read out loud to Aiden because I was laughing at it too hard, which is where Gotham the guy says, you're just a man in a mask, Batman. What are you going to do? Shoot a rope at me? And Batman goes, no, I'm going to crash a plane into you. And then Batman crashes a plane into.
Yeah, like the way that Gotham,
oh, I love it.
The way that Gotham the guy is portrayed as like hyper paranoid, mm-hmm. Is really well done. The way that it comes out in the dialogue, like because on 2 separate occasions, like somebody pulls something out of their pocket. Because there's a part at the beginning where Alfred is actually dressed as Batman, and like a weird almost.
God,
like,
that scene where Alfred.
It's like a Batman 66 nod, right?
Oh yeah, it's completely a Batman 66 nod. But I loved it. Alfred dressing up as Batman and having like an imaginary conversation with Thomas Wayne. Like, and not like the conversation that you usually see with Thomas Wayne, but like the, oh yes, Master Thomas, thank you for entrusting the care of your child to me. This is fantastic. This is going to be so easy. He's such a smart child.
Yeah, it's all...
Alfred's dressing up as Batman and like ramping up the Batmobile to 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's all sarcasm directed at the ghost of Thomas Wayne. But like Alfred pulls something out and Gotham's response to it is, what is that? And then Batman does it later, and he says, what is that again?
The way that this story has kind of played out with Psycho Pirate and with Hugo Strange kind of operating around the periphery is really fun. And the one big flaw with this story, I think. You know, these first five issues that are, you know, these are the ones that are going to be in the trade called I Am Gotham. And the big flaw with it is that it really does feel like the opening act for the rest of the run. Because the actual villain is going to be Hugo Strange. And I think that's awesome, because I love Hugo Strange, and I feel like Hugo Strange and the Monster Men are such a good background story to kind of play out over a year's worth of Batman comics, you know? But it does kind of, like if we didn't know from that first issue that Gotham was not long for this world, the guy, then we would absolutely, you know by the time Hugo Strange showed up and was like, no, guess what? I'm the real villain.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And again, like as much as there is to unpack from this story, I'm hooked on it as well. You know, like I'm really drawn into sort of the status quo that Tom King and David Finch have set for Batman and Duke and Gotham Girl, where they kind of have to be the support system for each other. It's interesting, for sure.
What did you think about the epilogue that had the... And I guess, like, we've already spoiled everything that happens in this issue, but spoiler warning if you don't want to know about the actual details of, like, the last page. What did you think about the epilogue where it's Gotham Girl, like, from, like, narrating from the future?
Yeah.
About how she and Duke Thomas got married.
And Batman's dead.
And Batman's dead. Well, I mean, of course.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it sort of gives, like, a finality to the stories that are coming that comics don't often have, because, you know, the future and the present in comics are so malleable. This, like, establishes an endpoint that the book has to get to, right? So it's going to be interesting seeing how it gets there. All right, up next we're going to talk fairly quickly about Supergirl Rebirth number one. You know, I'll admit that aside from the first issue, I did not really keep up with Supergirl, the New 52 Supergirl. So I don't really know what her status quo was at the time, up to, you know, what they're doing with her now in Rebirth. But I can say that this series, I think it's written by Steve Orlando and the art is by Emanuela Lupacino. This series does exactly what I want a Supergirl series to do. It establishes a great status quo for her. It gives her a Superman-like sort of semi-revised origin, even though I think it's probably tied into her New 52 origin as well. And also just, you know, her current status of being, you know, tied into the Danverses and also fucking Cameron Chase, who's all up in this book. The way that she reacts to the villains that show up here, where she kind of shows up and she knows that she's going to have to fight them because she's a superhero, but she also reacts with, you know, a lot of empathy and a real desire to want to understand the criminals, the bad elements that she's fighting. Also, there's a Kryptonian werewolf in this issue.
You know, like, I have not read this one yet. I do want to, because Steve Orlando was amazing on Midnighter. You had me at Cameron Chase. Like, I think it was either you or Benito who messaged me, and you were like, hey, Cameron Chase is in Supergirl. And I was like, well, I'm reading it, obviously. but you did not mention a Kryptonian werewolf until just now.
Yeah, there's some stuff in this issue about Red Kryptonite.
I just literally turned to face my microphone with my eyebrows up and a big smile on my face as soon as you said, like Tom Haverford style.
A Kryptonian character who feels like he was slighted by Supergirl's father back on Krypton has been affected deeply by Red Kryptonite, which led to the whole conflict between her dad and him to begin with. And then he shows up on Earth, and now he is a fucking red Kryptonian werewolf.
That's fantastic.
That Supergirl treats with empathy and treats with, you know, understands that he's a threat, but also wants to say, like, hey, can we work this out? Can we talk this out? So the characterization of Supergirl is right on the money. There's just a lot of fun stuff happening. Unlike so many of the Rebirth number one issues, this doesn't feel like just prologue. It feels like an issue of comics with a story. So it shares that with the Green Arrow Rebirth number one. So it's up there with my favorite Rebirth number ones. I just feel like there's a lot to like about this particular issue. And if it continues like this, then Supergirl is going to be one of the best Rebirth books.
Not surprising, given Orlando's track record.
Yeah, it's
at DC.
It's top shelf. All right, Chris, we're going to wrap up this segment. You want to talk a little bit about Backstagers number one?
You know, we talked just now about Steve Orlando's track record at DC, and I feel like that's a very similar thing to James Tynion the Fourth's track record at DC, where everything he's written there has been just something I've really, really loved. So I was really looking forward to reading Backstagers, and now that I have, it's very much the kind of book that I think Boom is becoming known for. You know, between like stuff like Lumberjane, stuff like Goldie Vance, stuff like Jonesy. Like if you like those, you're really going to have a good time with Backstagers. The premise is that there's a all-boys school and the drama club treats their backstage tech people as though they are invisible, which is a real shame because the tech people have portals to other dimensions hidden under the backstage area. It's really, really weird. It's really kind of charming. In that sort of same effortlessly charming way that you got from Lumberjanes or Jonesy. Absolutely worth checking out. Some really, really great visuals from Ryan Tsai. Just well worth reading. Especially given, you know, the kind of representation that we're going to be getting both on the page and from the creators. Is always a good thing to support. Just really, really fun stuff. Definitely check it out.
Well, that is all good to hear. Chris, we're going to get into our interview with Fred Van Lente in just a moment. But before we do that, we've got to talk a little bit about our sponsors at Loot Crate, who do a great service for their customers. I remember back in my younger days when I would just sit outside my house and I would beg the mail carrier whenever they came. I would just run up to their car and I would say, please, can you please bring me a box of 6 to 8 exclusive items that you can't get anywhere else from my favorite franchises? You know?
Okay, Matt, I want to stop you right there because, first of all, that's a very specific request for a child to make. And also, I'm not sure that is the purview of a postal worker.
I, you know, Chris, I didn't know who else to ask. Like, I mean,
I guess that's true. Like, you don't, like, if you can't talk to your mail carrier, who can you talk to?
Well, you know, in my youth, you know, I didn't understand how the world worked, you know? So I thought that my mail carrier was responsible for all the mail that came to my house. So I would just, you know, I'd run up to them and I would say, don't you have a box of 6 to 8 exclusive items that I can have for less than $20 a month? That you could just bring it to me every month, and it would have, you know, my favorite franchises of all time, like stuff like Marvel Comics and Fallout and RoboCop and Star Wars. You know,
Matt, can I also stop you here? And when you were a child, you were a fan of RoboCop and Fallout.
Well, RoboCop, yeah, because that RoboCop cartoon.
Okay, that makes sense.
And with Fallout, it was more just the concept of Fallout, like nuclear Fallout.
You were asking for radioactive dust.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was a weird kid. So anyway, you know, my mail carrier would be like, I can't do that for you, kid. I just deliver the stuff that people send me. Like, if you want to get a box like that, then somebody's got to send it to you. And I would dejectedly walk back to my house, and I would watch the RoboCop cartoon, and you know, I'd be sad.
No, Matt, again, I need to ask for clarification here. Are you telling me that when you were a child, you would just be sitting there watching the RoboCop cartoon without any exclusive wearables, without any exclusive pins, without any cool t-shirts that you can't get anywhere else, without awesome stuff just like thrilling your tiny heart?
Yeah, that's all true. You know, that's all true.
That's Dickensian.
Yeah, it's Kafka-esque. But if only I had known back in 1988, the only year that the RoboCop cartoon was on.
So when you were 5 years old, you were having this conversation with your postal worker. Yeah. Okay.
If I had only known then that by the time 2016 rolled around, that there would be something like Loot Crate that does all those things. For less than $20 a month, you sign up for a Loot Crate. They send you 6 to 8 exclusive items every single month from your favorite stuff.
Again, I need a clarifying question, if I may. Now, is this just stuff that's like just at random? Is this just random stuff they throw in a box?
It is not. These are exclusive curated items that everybody who subscribes to Loot Crate gets in that particular month. Every month is themed. The August Loot Crate has come and gone. That ended at midnight on August 19th, but its theme was anti-hero, for example. So you're going to get a themed box full of items from your favorite franchises, and you will be happy in a way that young little 5-year-old Matt Wilson was not. So here's what you need to do. So you can have the happiness I was neglected in my childhood. Go to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax. Use the promo code WarRocketAjax. Get $3 off your subscription. Help us out on WarRocketAjax and get that box every month. Live vicariously. Or I'll live vicariously through you. I guess that's more accurate. Young me can live
vicariously. Yeah, I think what you're asking people to do is live for 5-year-old Matt Wilson.
That's right. Do what 5-year-old Matt couldn't. I usually don't get that personal on the show, Chris, but I felt like that had to be said.
You are notoriously reserved. Lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax. Coupon code WarRocketAjax.
All right, Chris. It's time now for our interview with Fred Van Lint.
Joining us for the program this week, we're very excited to have back on the show one of our good friends in the world of comic books. You will know him, I guess, most recently as the writer of Weird Detective over at Dark Horse. He's one of the guys behind Incredible Hercules. He's one of the guys behind Action Philosophers. The Silencers. There's one I bet you haven't heard about in a while.
Been a while.
His latest project is Generation Zero, out from Valiant, coming up this week. Fred Van Lint, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Every time you're on the show, every time we talk, every time we do an interview, I always come away with an interesting new book that I want to read. Okay. I think when you were on talking about Archer and Armstrong, we talked about, what was it, Zero, the Biography of a Dangerous Idea? That's still on my Amazon wish list.
That's a good one.
Haven't gotten around to actually reading it yet, but I want to. And I know that you are a guy who reads and researches constantly.
Yes.
Opening question, before we get into the specifics of Generation Zero, before we get into anything about the other stuff that you're doing concurrently with that, what are you reading and what should I read?
What am I reading right now? I am reading The Making of the President 1960 by, I believe the journalist's name is Theodore White, because I am working on, with my oft partner in crime, Mr. Ryan Dunleavy of Action Philosophers and Comic Book History of Comics fame, on Action Presidents, which will be coming out not next year, but the following year. Yes, we need to make you wait, have the anticipation build. It will be 2 birthdays of mine between now and when those books are released. It's the joy of working in mainstream book publishing. God bless HarperCollins. They put a lot of effort in these books. They're going to be awesome, but you're going to have to wait for them. And they're going to release all 4 books, all 440 pages of presidential awesomeness in 2018, which is kind of why they're being released in 2018, because Ryan has to draw them all. So the first book is Washington, the second book is Lincoln, the third book is Teddy Roosevelt in the fourth book is JFK. So Making the President 1960 obviously is about the struggle between JFK and Nixon to become president. And it is justly lauded. I'm really enjoying it. On the comic side, I just finished, and I'm late to this because I think this book came out in 2013, is I'm a huge Xander Cannon fan, and I just finished Heck, which is this amazing book he did for, I believe, Top Shelf, his drawing portal. About a guy who inherits a house from his dad that has a portal to hell in it, and he becomes a professional hell explorer, essentially. And I thought it was terrific.
Heck is the book that Xander Cannon released with Kevin Cannon in the Double Barrel series.
Okay.
The digital first series where they were sequentially putting those books out. I think on a pay what you want thing as well.
Okay.
Where sometimes they'd put like 10 new pages in a book and sometimes they'd put 30 new pages in a book because it was all digital so it didn't matter. And then right. Both of those got collected later. I think both by Top Shelf. But yeah. Heck is great.
Now, was the other one, was it Crater 15?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got both of those. I can literally, they were two of the first books I unpacked cause they're both weird sizes.
Yes.
And I got out the weird size books first and I have not read them. I've had them since they came out.
Well, Heck, you definitely should read, Chris, just cause it's on hand. Cause it really
wow,
is.
Wow. Okay. Fred Van Lente taking shots at Kevin Cannon. Right now.
Well, I'm not taking shots at Kevin Cannon. I did not read Kevin Cannon's book. But I guess, is that a shot? I don't know.
Fred Van Lente, you just said that you hated Kevin Cannon.
I thought that was more ignorance than malice. But, you know, it's stupidity theory, which is sort of a subset of Occam's razor, right? I don't believe in conspiracy theory. I believe in stupidity theory, which is essentially do not ascribe to malice, which is more easily explained by stupidity, so or incompetence. So that's the explanation now, there.
Fred, that was a beautiful segue into talking about Generation Zero.
Yeah, I'm psyched. I have to humble brag a bit because I did that because this week going to press is the French omnibus of Archer and Armstrong, which is the first book I did for Valiant, and which I'm very excited about is that the French omnibus is the entire run, which has never been done in any language ever. So I'm very psyched to get my hands on that book. And so I was expounding on stupidity theory that will ultimately be translated into French because the French need to know about stupidity theory, you guys. So it was sort of fresh in my mind. And what's cool about Generation Zero is I finally get to sort of go beyond the Ivar Time Walker, Geomancer, Eternal Warrior, Archer Armstrong realm corner of the Valiant universe, and now I'm doing something different.
You've been at Valiant in, you know, on one book or another pretty consistently since the 2012 relaunch,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think me and Venditti are the longest tenured Valiant creators at this point. And he's got 3 months on me because his XO came out. His was the first book and mine was the fourth.
Right, and he's also been on it like 450 straight issues.
Yes.
The one thing I wrote about this not too long ago because I was reading the current storyline in Venditti's Wrath of the Eternal Warrior book, which is just 100% death traps. It's all death traps all the time, and it's great, and I love it. That's what I'm here right. for. It occurred to me that at Valiant, the one thing that they do better than I think anybody else in comics right now, is they'll take characters that are, you know, pretty standard superhero archetypes. Like, you know, like, I love him, but Ninjak is pretty standard. Like, Ninjak by himself is pretty standard. Eternal Warrior, pretty standard. Even Archer and Armstrong for being, you know, the kind of mismatched duo. You know, one guy's a super good karate guy, and one guy is an immortal strong guy. Like, you can get him pretty easily.
Well, what's funny is when sorry, I don't mean to bogart your question, but what I love is you talk about the sort of standard archetypes. Valiant not long ago produced a smaller hardback of the original Barry Windsor Smith Archer Armstrong, and they're interviewing Jim Shooter, who was head of Valiant at the time, and like, well, where did Archer Armstrong come from? And he goes, yeah, I felt like we needed a buddy book, because every company has a buddy book. I'm like, do they? Is that really a thing? Like, is that really an archetype? Time, but apparently it was. It was their Power Man and Iron Fist, I guess. I don't know why, you know what the logic was there, but fair enough.
Now I'm really going to be racking my brain trying to figure out what the DC buddy book was. The Atom and Hawkman?
Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what the... Yeah, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess they do have that. But they take these standard archetypes, like these pretty, you know, easy characters to grasp, you know, and they put them in the weirdest high concepts.
Right.
And that's something that you did. And I was curious because I was wondering, was that part of the conversation back when Valiant started, or did they go to people like you, people like Greg, Pac, people like Robert Venditti, because they had done those high concept style stories in other books? Because there is, you know, there is a pretty direct line between Incredible Hercules and Archer and Armstrong.
Well, did I tell you, Chris, have I ever told you the story that Tom Brevoort told me about Incredible Hercules and Archer and Armstrong?
It's entirely possible that you have, but I'm sure we have new listeners.
Right. So, and I didn't know about this. So it's funny. It's a tough question. The simple answer to your question is it's a tough question for me to answer because I didn't hire me, you know? So it's like a lot of this behind the scenes stuff the creators don't know, right? Because our life with the project begins when someone calls us up and says, hey, do you want to do this? And very rarely does an editor or a publisher say, this is why I chose you, right? That part's always mysterious. But fairly shortly after, so for those of you listening who have no idea what the fuck we're talking about, Incredible Hercules was this book Greg Pak and I did for Marvel that was basically Hercules, who is the guy, Hercules. That was my favorite Hercules question. They're like, I went to this book called Incredible Hercules. And they go, you mean about Hercules the guy? Which I was sort of an amazing, like, as opposed to a superhero who I guess, like, had a beard on his chest and, like, pretended to be, like, I'm faux Hercules or I'm science Hercules or whatever the idea was. And so Hercules.
Right, hang on to science Hercules because that is public domain.
That's right. Science Hercules. That's right. Write that down. Non-existent intern who's in the corner as I'm recording this. Hercules was basically training this teen genius Domitius Cho, who's now the Hulk. So, comics, everybody. And this is a concept that sort of came out of Marvel because they were main characters in this big storyline, World War Hulk, that Marvel had done. And they were pitching it in the room, and Tom Brevoort, and people were like, is this too crazy as a concept? And Tom Brevoort was like, no, it should just be, it's like an Archer and Armstrong. And that, Tom kind of vetting this, and sort of comparing it to the Valiant Archer and Armstrong was what got Incredible Hercules greenlit. Years later, Valiant comes to me at New York Comic Con and says, do you want to do Archer and Armstrong? And I'm like, sure. And then I go home and Google Archer and Armstrong because I have no idea what they're talking about. I've never heard of Archer and Armstrong. I didn't read the Valiant comics when they first came out in the early 90s. And then I read the description of Archer and Armstrong, which is what Chris said, where it's the strong man and the sort of innocent, naive kung fu kid, and I was like, oh, okay, this is close enough to Incredible Hercules, and then it was only after my Archer and Armstrong came out that Tom Brevoort, I happened to be at Marvel, and Tom Brevoort told me the story that the whole reason Incredible Hercules was greenlit was because it was like Archer and Armstrong, and the whole reason I got the Archer and Armstrong job was because I had done Incredible Hercules, even though I'd never heard of Archer and Armstrong, which was the reason Incredible Hercules was greenlit in the first place. So, go figure that out. Life is strange.
I think you said it there. That there's so much there's so much that happens behind the scenes that we never see. We never know why anything is happening.
We never know about, you know.
So, Fred, I guess that that all leads to the question of what makes Generation Zero different from the other stuff that you've done, and is it so different that people aren't going to like it? Because
I hope so. That's why I did it. That's why I made it so different, so people would be repelled from the work. No, Valiant came to me and wanted to do a teen book, and after kind of, you know, bopping around some of the stuff that other folks had created, I sort of settled on this team that Josh Dysart, my buddy Josh Dysart, created for Harbinger Wars, which was the first big Valiant intercompany event called Generation Zero, who were these kind of human weapons raised by Project Rising Spirit, which is this big evil defense contractor in the Valiant universe, also created Bloodshot. And they were basically kids, teenagers, who'd been raised as human weapons and escaped and are now kind of roaming the earth. And we sort of hit upon the idea that they would sort of be like this freelance, pro bono, paramilitary teen rescue force, as they like to call themselves. And if you can find them on the internet, on Channel Zero, on Snapchat, and tell them your problem, and they think your problem is worthy of their attention, they will show up in your town. I like the idea of... I just sort of like the idea of teen superheroes in general. The pitch I've been telling people is it's Archie meets the Authority, and that these are super powerful people, humans, who are also have raging hormones, and all the self-righteousness and poor decision-making that comes with being a teenager. So, and there's no Professor X to sort of show them the way, right? They're just kind of totally runaways on their own, doing their own thing. And so they turn up in this girl's town in Michigan, and that she has a very serious problem that they're going to try and solve, and they're going to solve it with lots of death rays and explosions and property damage. And summoning them your town is kind of a Pandora's box opening, you know? There's good and bad stuff.
Fred, I don't want to nitpick, but yes. That's just the A-team, bro.
I know, right? That the original concept was sort of teen A-team. There are far fewer cabbage cannons in this comic. I'm also, you know, it's really tragic, you guys, just being a comics creator in the modern era where you go from town to town and you meet all these famous people. I got into a huge fight with this older gentleman in a restaurant in Houston before Houston Comic Con, and I was with my pal Frank Barbieri, the great writer. And Frank looked at me, he goes, to make a very long story short, Mr. Benedict supports Mr. Trump, and I do not. And I believe in climate change, and he thinks it's a plot to destroy America and Christianity. I thought that was sort of interesting. And so the guy leaves, storms off, and Frank goes, dude, that was faith. I was like, seriously? Like, that's Dirk Benedict, Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, and Face from the A-Team? And it was. Face got in my face, Chris. And for that reason, I find it very hard to be as pro-A-Team and to associate my work with the A-Team as much as I did prior to this unfortunate encounter in the Houston. It was like the Houston Medical Center Marriott restaurant. It was totally insane. Old white guys really like Trump, and it was an ugly scene. I tried to maintain my composure, but you know, some bullshit you just can't let stand. It escalated quickly.
Fred, I like having you on the show, and I'll tell you why.
Tell me.
Because I'm doing my best here, buddy, to give you a shot to promote your book, and you get. You got two sentences into describing your book, and then immediately started talking about how you got in a fight with Dirk Benedict.
I know, right? Well, it's, you know, it's the joy and curse of being me. What can I say?
How do you expect me to make this interview about anything else now? Other than like a blow by blow of your fight with Face,
I'm not quite sure what else there is to say about Face, other than he's deeply strange.
Okay, look, there's one thing I gotta know, and then we'll get back to talking about Generation Zero in a second. Was he like at a neighboring table talking about how climate change isn't real, and you were just like, and you had to insert yourself into this conversation? Did he like come over?
This is literally what happened. He sat down. Frank and I were having dinner. And this is the night before the con opens, and this dude sits down at the table next to us. He's a sort of good-looking, older dude in sort of a sort of kind of a generically Hollywood way. So I knew he was with the con, and other con people were kind of coming up to him. And if you're attending a Comic-Con and you're at the hotel, it's not the hardest task in the world to discern between the people who are there for the con and the civilians. So I knew this dude was with the con. And he asked me what I was drinking. I told him the brand of the beer I was drinking, and I recommended to him, and he said, fine. So that was fine. Frank and I are talking. Then I excuse me, I got to go to the can. I come back from the can, and Frank and Face and the waiter are engaged in this quote-unquote discussion about how horrible smartphones are and about how the kids – I'm not sure if you two are aware of this, but the kids spend all their time looking at their smartphones. And they don't look up, you know, and they don't interact with the world around them. I sort of sat down and made a joke. Well, you know, well, they'll certainly look up on their smartphones in the future when, you know, we're running out of water and that's all they have to worry about. And then that kind of set them off onto this tirade about how climate change was, it was a hoax. So people want to destroy capitalism and they want to destroy, I didn't quite understand why Christianity was a part of this conspiracy theory, but apparently the evil ones who are promoting climate change want to do that as well. And, you know, I'm often, I don't know if you guys find this, I'm often shocked at whenever you assert yourself with these people, how their hysteria level ratchets up to 11 almost immediately, which I think indicates how few people actually stand up to them, and they're just like, okay, you know. I'm just going to write out this rant about, oh, and because he was obsessed with peak oil, I guess that was his thing in the 70s. Like, there was one Newsweek cover about peak oil, that we're all going to run out of oil by 1979, and that didn't happen. Therefore, every other thing scientists have said since 1979 is bullshit. So, but because that's just logic, you guys. That's just, you know, that's...
It checks out.
I mean, this seems like a logical conclusion. You know, it just rapidly descended into him wagging his finger in my face and him getting up and gesticulating while I sat there and attempted to engage with him.
Can I tell you the most surprising thing about this story?
It got to the classic level of all climate change denial, which is that there's snow, ergo there's no climate change. So, you know.
Fred, can I tell you the most surprising part of the story?
Yes.
The most surprising part of the story is that you had to be informed after he left that it was Dirk Benedict, allegedly.
It was totally Dirk.
and that he did not pull out.
Who was that guy? Yeah.
That he did not pull out, do you know who I am, like, immediately.
Actually, I think he said, because I've never seen the original Battlestar Galactica, I think he did say he was working at Battlestar Galactica, because I've never seen, I only know him as face. I was too young for Battlestar Galactica, so I think he made a reference, like, back when I was in Battlestar Galactica, they were saying peak oil was a thing, but we still have oil, you guys.
I was wondering, Fred, when you said these people, if you meant members of the A-Team.
The Cylons.
People who played Starbuck.
Right.
Or people who have appeared on Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld, because I'm looking at this great screenshot of Dirk Benedict on from the Red Eye bonus room.
Okay. What was amazing was that was also Houston Comic Con, which was the huge Sons of Anarchy blowout. That was a whole other thing. I've never seen so many cops at a comic book convention in my life. You know, I mean, shockingly, when you do a TV show about, you know, drug dealing bikers, like, a lot of your fans end up being really violent bikers, and it didn't work out too well for Houston Comic Con. Oh man, that was without a doubt the craziest show I'd ever been to, and the Dirk Benedict was only like the third craziest thing that happened to me at that point during the show. But as Chris pointed out, I'm not here to promote Dirk Benedict or the Houston Comic Con, but if you can go to the Houston Comic Con, it's a great show, crazy celebrities, crazy stuff happens. I highly recommend it.
Well, okay, to get back to talking about Generation Zero.
Are you sure we can't stay on Houston Comic Con for another 3 hours?
In comparison to the A-Team, I don't think that one thing that you would necessarily say about the A-Team is that there is an air of mystery about them, necessarily. That is absolutely the case with Generation Zero, because so much of this, the first issue of the series focuses on, you know, the young woman, the teenage girl who calls them instead of the team themselves. In fact, there's a little bit of a bait and switch involving, you know, the team.
Yes.
That's a difference from the A-Team. Is your plan to kind of keep them mysterious throughout the series, or is this just kind of a mysterious introduction where we're going to get to know them a lot better in the issues to come?
What I dug about it, and sort of where I was going with the Archie meets the Authority comparison, is that I like the idea of taking super beings, almost treating them like creatures of folklore, where they are mysterious and beautiful, but also dangerous, and mortals don't do very well when they come into contact with them. And also there's these weird rituals to summon them. You know, it's not like you write a little note on a tree and put it in a stump or whatever in the swamp. We've updated this in Generation Zero to have it be online, and you've got to kind of make your call, and they show up or they don't show up. And as you guys saw from the first issue, their enemies are very almost kind of folklore-y as well. So what I was sort of super interested in was the idea of making superheroes kind of scary to normal people. And to me, that's even heightened when you put in the teenage milieu where everything is kind of scary and new and different and exciting, or at least it should be when you're a teenager. And so I don't know if they will remain as mysterious as the series progresses, but they will definitely remain dangerous and unpredictable.
You talked a little bit about the villains that they're fighting in that first issue. Yes. And I have one question. Are they speaking in anagrams?
I don't know. Are they?
Yes, they are, because I ran their dialogue through the internet anagram server.
Right.
Aiden is always really surprised, because I can, like, I have been reading Batman comics for my entire life, so every time I see text arranged in, like, a block, I attempt to read it as an anagram, or as an acrostic, or anytime I see words that seem put together strangely, right, I will read them as anagrams, like, instantly, because I'm always on the lookout for the Riddler.
Exactly, right. I don't know if you found a lot of insight in running them the dialogue through the anagram generator, but yeah, obviously they're totally speaking in anagrams.
It was weird. Like, I had to really get out a pencil and do some work too.
Right.
And I was like, that is one of those comic booky things. It's the kind of thing you can only do in comics, you know?
Yeah.
That I love. And like, is that something you've been wanting to do for a while? Because you've come, like, you have a knack for kind of doing adversaries in really weird ways. Like, we talked about the bad guys in Archer and Armstrong a couple years ago, with, you know, like, and I know Matt was a huge fan of Nothing Is Forever, that beautiful, beautiful line. but, you know, you did the Hitler Village was one of yours, for right. instance.
From Taskmaster, yeah.
Yeah, and the Commedia del Morte was one of yours as well, so.
Right. Power Man, Iron Fist. Yeah.
Do you just have a notebook of bad guy ideas that you can drop into any story, or does each one new and bespoke?
Yeah, I guess it's different every time. I mean, what I liked about the Cornermen, is it the Cornermen, who are called the Cornermen for sort of obvious reasons that'll become super obvious shortly. A lot of it's sort of taken up some stuff I've read, whether it's comics, whether it's short stories or something else. A lot of it's just sort of funny. Like, to a certain extent, I kind of avoid pun names and titles just because you want stuff to be kind of read internationally and you want stuff that translates well. But I don't know, the idea of the Corner Men and the Killing Manifest through 93 Annals, I just thought was hilarious. And so I kind of stuck on that. And the fact that these are somewhat other words, you want to figure out a way to sort of have this idea. I guess what I wanted was an effect kind of like the dwarf and the dream sequences from Twin Peaks, you know, where he's speaking backwards. And so the anagrams are sort of a simple way to kind of get the fact that these are creatures that are being translated into our world from another one. You know what I mean? And so you're getting kind of a scrambled, there's some kind of static going on that we don't understand what it is. You know what I mean?
It really works well. I always, like, I love your characterization of heroes and good guys, and obviously all of your stories about celebrity encounters that you have. But, like, the thing that I think sticks out the most about your work is how good the villains end up being and how cleverly they're put together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a strong believer in particularly in the superhero genre, you're only as good as your villains, you know, and everything that I love about superheroes, whether it's Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom and Batman, the Joker, and whatever you have. I mean, to me, my number one superhero was always Spider-Man, and it's always kind of annoying me. Spider-Man does not really have that. Green Goblin and Dr. Octopus are both kind of silly, you know, and in their own way, people have tried to make them more plausible, but really the attraction of Spider-Man's always been Peter Parker.
Hey, Fred, can you excuse me for a second while I have a sidebar with Matt Wilson real quick?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, hey, Chris, what's up?
Yeah, Matt, listen, I know, look, I agree with you. I know that you're going to want to tell him that he's wrong about Spider-Man villains.
There's a kind of an inherent silliness to Doc Ock and Green Goblin, but I think they can, you know, I think that they've been put in serious stories in you know, good ways and used really well.
Listen, do you think I don't want to talk about the Enforcers right now? Do you think that's not what I want to do right now?
Please? I mean, I can bring up Kraven, but I think we should just move on probably.
I love Kraven. Unfortunately, Kraven was dead when I was writing.
Hey, Fred, we're back. We're back from that sidebar.
No, I mean, I feel like you need to put a little bit of work into the Spider-Man villain. That's why one of my favorite things ever done was the Chameleon storyline in Amazing Spider-Man, is I really like the idea of taking the Chameleon, who in Spider-Man number one was just this spy who was a master of disguise, and sort of I wanted to put him kind of back on that level and make him a legit threat to Spider-Man like it was originally, and to kind of take away from him the fact I can shape change. To me, it's more interesting if he's just a dude who is really good at one thing and can still give Peter a run for his money. That's what I find super interesting.
I really want there to be a chameleon-themed villain who can just slightly change his colors.
Right. Camo man.
Yeah, he stands in front of a wall and he turns light purple.
I think like, that's there was all. I feel like there was a Tick villain or a Tick hero who kind of did that.
It's like Wallpaper Man, right? He can just kind of...
Like, on the cartoon, there was a guy who just changed colors.
Matt, as you know, I do not recognize the Tick cartoon as canon.
Fred, we're going to get to Twitter questions here in a second, but before we do, I wanted to ask one quick thing about sort of your genre inspiration.
Sure.
For Generation Zero, because, you know, we talked about the air of mystery to the team. And there's absolutely kind of like a conspiracy thriller feel to the book, but I also get a lot of horror in the book because you know Keisha's little brother is sitting drawing on the you know drawing stuff on the floor. He's doing Spirograph by hand,
yeah,
and that's kind of a you know a horror movie trope almost. You know the way that the villains show up is kind of a horror feel, like the location of the teen party by the lake, and then she gets a package
by the slurry pit.
Yes,
she gets a package in the issue that sort of is evocative of kind of a horror feel to it. So it almost feels like you're doing kind of a mix of genres here. I'm just kind of interested to hear you talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, I mean, a lot of this comes from fairy tales and folk tales, and you know, Hansel and Gretel is about some kids who fall in the clutches of a cannibal, you know, and you know, the original version of the Cinderella involves this really painful shoe being forced on people's feet and stuff, and so I did, and you know, Snow White, she gets poisoned and dies, and there's the horrible, you know, run through the forest, and there's an evil witch and stuff. So I you know, and a lot of it, you know, I finished the script several months ago, but now that Stranger Things is on Netflix, I've been watching it and really loving it, and being like, oh, okay, this is. I feel like this was scooped out of my brain. A lot of the stuff that's happening in Generation Zero, I see a lot of affinities towards. And so I feel like that also has that kind of folklore, you know, the Steven Spielberg, Stephen King axis kind of going on there. But yeah, without a doubt, it is a huge horror influence going on there.
And with that, I think we're going to kick it over to our listeners on Twitter for a few questions for Fred Van Lente. Matt, if people want to get in on these discussions that we have every week here on War Rocket Ajax, how exactly can they go about that?
First of all, what they need to do is they need to make a political decision, okay? We've got a very important political – people need to have a very important political decision coming up, and that is to decide whether or not to maintain and retain their membership in the Dirk Benedict fan club. If you are feeling like what he said has some merit to it and you feel like Peak Oil was also bullshit, hang on to that card.
Will you face the pain?
If you're with Fred, then you got to tear that card up and throw it in the trash.
Face the Fred or Fred the face? Wait.
That's right. This is the most important fan club membership decision of our lifetimes. Yep. So So please, please make that decision. Then go sign up for an account on twitter.com. Find the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Follow both of us. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. And one of us will put out the call for questions for our guest. And you can ask a question just like the ones you're about to hear for Fred Van Lente.
They've been popping up on my monitor. I want to say all of these questions are excellent. And
I'm very the first question is actually for all of us. This is from RomCom Your Mom on Twitter. RomCom Your Mom wants to know, what is, in your opinion, the worst time-traveling trope of all time?
It kind of wants to leave something negative. I mean, I guess there are things I don't like about a bunch of time travel movies, but so rarely do they have anything to do with the actual time travel. Like, if we could take Joseph Gordon-Levitt's nose away from Looper, I would probably be 50% happier with the movie. So I would say the worst time travel trope would be makeup that tries to make Joseph Gordon-Levitt look like Bruce Willis.
That's a good one.
I feel like this episode of Ajax is just Fred Van Lente racking up enemies.
the actors of America are going to try and hunt me down now.
The SAG is coming after you tomorrow.
That's right. I'm done. I'm never going to get that part now.
Chris, do you have a least favorite time traveling trope?
Well, we've been over on Sailor Business. We're in the part of Sailor Moon R where there's a lot of time travel, and just none of it makes any sense. It always bugs me when people are, like, late arriving in time travel stories. When stuff like that happens, it's a real pain.
Yeah, I have a similar gripe, like, where people get stranded for a long time. When, if there's a time machine, you could just come back and get them. And there always has to be some explanation of, like, well, we couldn't pinpoint the time to come back, so you had to be stuck in the 50s for 2 years.
Bro, are you talking specifically about Legends of Tomorrow?
That is something that definitely happened.
Example.
That definitely happened on Legends of Tomorrow. I also think it's weird that there's never any consequences to the whole don't meet yourself in the past thing. Like, right. That comes up in every time travel thing, right? Like, hey, don't meet yourself in the past.
I never understand why that's bad. That's never really – I mean, I know that I've read a couple of stories, like, particularly – like Marvel 2-in-1 when Vance Astro met himself. That's a
– yeah.
A galaxy reference. But, yeah, I don't understand why that would be bad. I don't understand the physics of that. I never understood that.
The explanation is always that it could cause a rip in the space-time continuum.
That's not a thing.
It never happens.
But that's because it's not a thing. It's not
yeah.
Like, I'm ripping this. What does that even mean? I don't understand what that means.
You know what time travel story has, like, the tightest and most understandable representation of time travel? It's Bill and Ted.
Well, it is George Carlin, so that's automatically the right answer. So, I'm done.
Our next question comes from Lucas Brown, Lokified, on Twitter. He asks, Fred, given the chance, would you do an Action Philosopher spinoff just about Plato's wrestling career?
That's a great idea. That's never occurred to me. The answer to that is an emphatic yes. Plato was an actual – Ryan and I, before we did the present Action Presence thing, we did this book, Action Philosophers, which was the lives and thoughts of history's A-list brain trust brought to you in a hip and humorous comic book fashion. No, I've not said that for the last 10 years, so I haven't kind of branded in my brain. But Plato means broad in Greek, essentially, so that was actually Plato's real name begins with an A in Greek, and I can't pronounce it. But Plato was his stage name when he was a wrestler, and so Plato was, in fact, for a period of time before he got into philosophy, a pro wrestler. So, Chris, I'm seeing a team up here with mutual interests, wrestling and philosophy combined.
Oh, yeah, I've wanted this since day one of Action Philosophers, Fred.
I like it. Actually, what we need now, then, is to combine these two questions that Plato brought into the present. Here we go. Now we're cooking with gas. Plato taking on Vince McMahon in the WWE, because he can use both his mind and his body to crush the enemies of professional wrestling. Not that the Vince is necessarily an enemy, but I don't know. It's just riffing.
While we're on pro wrestling, here is our not quite weekly tweet from @StoneColdHCC. an account that was created only to ask War Rocket Ajax questions.
There you go. It's the best kind of account.
This is the fourth tweet they have ever sent.
Please tweet us and let us know what the HCC stands for.
Stone Cold asks, and I can't do the voice because I'm like all froggy right now, but just imagine I did it. He asks, how much you want to bet I could win in a race versus a horse?
$5.
That's a good bet. $5 is a good standard bet amount.
I went to look just as you were saying it, and just the picture is right there, and I just hear it in the voice in my head.
I wish I could do the voice right now, but I'm like half sick, so I can't do it.
$5 and whatever is in like the coin pocket of my wallet. That's what I'm wagering.
You know what? I would pay $5 just to see him race right? horse.
I feel like it's a worthy investment.
Yeah.
Only if he's racing that horse through the bust-ass course on the Broken Skull Ranch.
Our next question comes from at real last name on Twitter, Jonathan Dick.
I like
Jonathan asks...
It's a great Twitter handle real name combination.
Jonathan asks, why don't more comics feature toilets eating people?
Because Weird Detective, my creator-owned series from Dark Horse, out now, has cornered the market on them.
Yeah.
Quick question, Fred, follow-up to that. Is that something you were scared of as a child, or am I a weirdo? Because I was, like, I remember having a lot of toilet anxieties as a child.
Where that comes from is I did Habitat for Humanity when I was a senior in high school, and so we went in the middle of the Appalachians to build people houses, oftentimes because they had their houses were falling apart, or one instance, the house was largely made of, and I'm not making this up, broken down six-pack, I don't know what you call it, sleeves, cartons, and like 12 packs, you know, of beer, like they were stapled together to form a house, and you know, didn't stand up very well against the rain. So my sister was staying with one of the host families, and they were trying to potty train their child. And the kid's trying to pee in the toilet when the seat fell on his dick. And he ran out saying, mommy, mommy, the toilet bit me, the toilet bit me. And that's the sort of story that stays with you. And then it often manifests itself in a horror comic. So... Does that answer your question, Chris?
In a way that went beyond what I hoped.
Anyway.
Did not hope.
Our next question is from CM Rowling on Twitter. Chris Rowling.
Love that dude.
He asks, what is the most unbelievable thing that an editor has ever let slide?
That's a tough one because it's kind of proving a negative because they never tell you. Like you only hear about the stuff they're trying to stop, right? So it's hard to say. Like most of the stuff that I've tried to get away with have been caught at because I've been fairly blatant about it and like told them in emails that I was trying to get away with it. That's a good question. Oh no, here we go. Okay, here's a great one. So in the aforementioned Incredible Hercules, spoiler alert, Hercules dies at one point, and so there's a funeral. There's a scene in the funeral where a bunch of Hercules' past lovers show up. So like, I guess it's Black Widow and Snowbird slept with Hercules in our run, and I forget some of the other characters. And
Gamora is there.
Gamora, right. And they're like going, you know, I can't remember what the actual line is, but it's something like, you know, let's all trade stories of when we had sex with Hercules and it was awesome. And Sue Storm's in the background, and she's like, oh, gotta go, and she just disappears. And we got a note back from Marvel saying, you know, you can't have Sue Storm having – like the logic was – the only way in Marvel continuity that Sue Storm would have slept with Hercules would be when she was after she was already married to Reed Richards, which was this kind of arcane continuity thing that annoyed us because the whole joke was just going to be like, I mean, it was just a throwaway joke, so we didn't give a shit whether she was married or they were boyfriend, girlfriend, or they hadn't been committed yet or whatever. So we were like, fuck it, make it Northstar. So instead of Sue Storm disappearing in the background, saying, oh, gotta go, can't talk about sleeping with Hercules, which made it North Star, who's like, oh, gotta go, and he runs away in the background, and they let it, and that's the comic, that's the published comic, because it's not, we replaced Sue Storm with a dude, and they're like, yeah, okay, as long as it's not Sue Storm, I'm down with it, and that's like one of the first, like, earliest indications that Hercules was bi. In fact, I think it's the first indication in comics that it was bi, and we just did it because they wouldn't give us Sue Storm. And I just thought that was hilarious. And that's now like a big deal on the internet, I've noticed.
It is indeed a big deal. The next question we have.
Good question.
The next question is from, I think this might be our last one too, is from Seth_Bingo. Roberto wants to know, are modern day philosophers less action oriented? And who's the Bruce Willis of modern philosophy?
Wow, a lot of action philosophers got questions. That's cool. It's not so much that modern-day philosophers are less action-oriented, but I have to admit the couple times in the last 10 years I've tried to read them, I've kind of like fallen asleep. So I guess maybe the answer to that question is yes, they are less action-oriented because it's hard for me to kind of keep my focus while reading them. What is Bruce Willis? Who's the Bruce Willis of philosophy?
Of modern philosophy.
Like modern philosophy. That would have to be Bruce Willis.
I was going to say Bruno.
Yes, exactly.
It's not as much as you might want it to be. It is not Slavoj Žižek.
No. I'd have to say the Bruce Willis of philosophy has to be Bruce Willis.
I think that is going to wrap us up for Twitter questions. Thanks to everybody who sent those in. Fred Van Lente, it has been a delight, as always, having you on the show. Before we let you go, please let all our listeners know where they can find you online.
Sure. If you can spell my name, you can find me on Twitter, on Facebook. It's also my Gmail address. It's my .com. So I'm super accessible.
All right. Our guest has been Fred Van Lente. His current projects include Weird Detective Out from Dark Horse and the one that he was here to talk about.
Which we did some.
We absolutely stayed on topic for the entire time. Generation Zero from Valiant. Definitely check that out. That is out this week. At your local comic book store and digitally. Fred, it's always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. So thank you for joining us once again. Thanks once again to Fred Van Lente for joining us. Definitely check out Generation Zero. And I guess don't talk to face?
Yeah, if there's one lesson to be learned from this episode of War Rocket Ajax, it's don't talk to face. But what you should do is vote for panel president.
Right, Matt, this is our ongoing project for the year 2016. We are taking lists of comic book characters and we are arranging them on a list, best to worst. We're going to eventually do every character in comic books. Right now, the list stands at 104 entries with a little over three months left in the year. We have Spider-Man, Peter Parker, clocking in at number one, and we have at number 104... the Hemogoblin.
This list comes from Pedro Picare, and I think we might have some difficulty with it, but I want to see. All right?
Okay.
The first one on Pedro's list is Robin Dick Grayson, a.k.a. Ooh. Nightwing, a.k.a. Grayson.
A.k.a. Agent 37.
A.k.a. Batman.
A.k.a. Batman, yeah. He's great. He's real, real good. I think he goes in the top 10.
Yeah, it's hard to discount.
I mean, we've got a pretty stacked, packed, especially in the back, top 10 right now.
Now, here's the question, Chris. You've said many times that Tim Drake is your favorite Robin.
Tim Drake is my favorite Robin, yes.
But is Dick Grayson your favorite character who has been Robin?
Yes.
That's an important distinction.
Yeah, Dick Grayson, to me, and to I think a lot of people around our age, and maybe a little older, maybe a little younger, didn't really come into his own for us until he was Nightwing. Especially if you were growing up in the 90s, especially if you were reading the Chuck Dixon, Scott McDaniel series. Like, that was Dick Grayson for me in a way that Dick Grayson was never Robin, if that makes sense. And that's not to say that, like, I wasn't... Like, obviously, I watched Batman 66, I read comics, I had Batman the Animated Series... You know, Untold Legend of the Batman, he's Robin in, which was my very formative book. But he was never Robin for me. He was Nightwing for me. So yeah, he is by far my favorite character who has ever been Robin. But I prefer him in different roles. Tim, I think, is a better Robin. Dick is a better character.
Okay, so if Dick's going to crack our top 10. Mm-hmm. He will at least have to go above Lex Luthor.
Yeah. I mean, I like Lex a lot, but yeah, like I'm looking at the biggest problem with this list right now is that we don't have a lot of women in the top 10.
Yeah.
Which I think is a shame. And maybe that's because, you know, could be because of us and who we really like. It could be because of the list that we're getting from listeners, but our highest ranking woman on the list is number 9, Squirrel Girl.
I think it has a lot to do with 80 years of comics also.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty big problem. I mean, we've got, like, right outside of the top 10, like, in 11 to 20, we've got Batwoman, we've got Big Barda, we've got Mary Jane. But it's, like, it's both weird that Squirrel Girl is our highest-ranking one, and also that she's the only woman in the top 10. I would hesitate to push her lower down the list, but in my heart of hearts, it's like, how can we not put Dick Grayson, like, at least around where Hellboy is at 7?
Okay, do you think he goes... I don't think he goes above the Thing.
I don't think he goes above the Thing either.
But I think he could go above Hellboy.
I think either right above or right below Hellboy. I think he's better than Jughead.
Yeah,
which that's a monumental accomplishment. But
in my heart, I feel like he goes, especially with what's been done with him over the past few years. I feel like he could go above Hellboy.
Yeah, but then I think that's where we put him, entering the list at number 7. Dick Grayson, alias Robin, alias Batman, alias Nightwing. It was Batman again. Agent 37.
All right. Up next on Peter's list is Robin 2, Jason Todd.
Jason Todd.
We actually have already ranked Jason Todd. So
have we already ranked him?
Okay, he's low. He's below Donna Troy.
Yeah, I did not want to have to go through that again. Okay, yep, there he is. Jason Todd.
All right. Next on
number 88 currently.
Yep. Next on Peter's list, Robin 3, Tim Drake.
Tim Drake's real, real good, dude. Tim Drake's real, real good. Now, I think the question is... Now, are you a Tim Drake guy, Matt?
I do like Tim Drake. I don't know. I was first introduced to Dick Grayson Robin, as I feel like many were. But comics Robin is definitely Tim Drake to me.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really genuinely surprised that he's not Robin still. Like, even with Damian Wayne...
I mean, he is, even with, sort with, of.
With Thomas. He's Red Robin? He's
Red
which
Robin.
Is a terrible name.
Yeah. But, like, that's all but Robin, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's just I don't understand why we can't just still call him Robin. Why we can't have a bunch of them running around. I'm a huge Tim Drake guy. I'm glad that Tim Drake's kind of like back into prominence as part of the cast of Detective right now. But he's, you know, again, he's my generation's Robin. I think the question that we need to ask, because this is the benchmark for him, is he better than Jim Gordon?
I think no.
But when we rank Jim Gordon, we rank Jim Gordon because of basically one story.
I mean, yes and no. Like, yeah, year one is the formative Jim Gordon story.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, in all honesty, Jim Gordon is nothing for 50 years. And then year one happens, and he's the best.
But there's been lots of Jim Gordon stuff that's been good after that.
There has been. I would venture to say that there's been as much good Tim Drake stuff as there has good Jim Gordon stuff. I don't know if I would... I mean, I certainly don't like any storyline in Robin as much as I like any storyline in Gotham Central. But Jim Gordon's not in a lot of Gotham Central, you know?
Yeah, but he's not, because there's another commissioner by that point.
Yeah, Akins.
I think what hurts Tim Drake is that he's the third Robin. So, like, by the time Tim Drake shows up, anything that could happen to him, it's like, well, he'd just get another Robin, right? He's by the time you get to three, it's like, okay, all right, we've had a lot of Robins. We get it. And Gordon is Gordon, right? Like, you're not, there's not another Jim Gordon. Like, nobody remembers Akins.
Mm-hmm. I do. I literally just remembered him.
You did. But,
okay,
you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I absolutely get what you're saying. But I feel like that ends up working in Tim's favor. Because the thing I like about Tim, and I think the thing that draws a lot of people to Tim, is that idea that, you know, like, he says it in the comics. He's like, yeah, you know, like, you know, Dick wanted to be Batman, and I just wanted to be Robin.
Yeah.
And I think wanting to be Robin and not necessarily planning to become Batman and like embracing Robin as an identity of its own is a really strong, like, reason of why I love Tim so much.
I'm gonna say he's not as important as Jim Gordon, which is a weird thing to say. But I'm going to pull a weirdly comparable on you, okay?
Okay.
I feel like he is very comparable to Kitty Pryde.
No, I can see that. I can absolutely see that.
Because Kitty Pryde is, after, you know, quite a few years of X-Men, mm-hmm. is a reader's entry point to X-Men, right?
Right.
Tim Drake's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, he's like, more comparable to Jubilee.
Yeah.
Because in the way that Kitty Pryde was kind of the prototype of that viewpoint character for the X-Men, like Dick and then early Jason were the viewpoint character for Batman. And Tim's the refinement. He's the Jubilee.
Yeah, we haven't ranked Jubilee yet, so I was just going with somebody on our list.
Fair. Look, I like Jubilee too. I think he's better than Kitty Pryde.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think Tim Drake's better than Kitty Pryde.
All right, here's who's above Kitty Pryde. Charlie Brown.
Good.
Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin. Mary Jane Watson. And then Gordon is right there.
I know in my heart that I would rather read a Tim Drake story than a story that was focused on Green Goblin. But I feel like you might have the opposite viewpoint on that.
Yeah, I would. That said, I would not be averse to putting Tim Drake between Mary Jane and Green Goblin.
I think that's where he's got to go, though.
Okay.
I think Tim Drake goes there.
Okay.
I'm starting to feel like there might be a pattern with this list.
The next one on Pedro's list is Stephanie Brown, who we've already ranked. And the last one on his list is Carrie Kelly.
There's a problem there in that Carrie Kelly only appears in four issues. She does not ever make any other appearances. There are no other appearances of Carrie Kelly.
Except for the version of Carrie Kelly who appeared in New 52, Batman and Robin after Damian died?
Yeah, that was a weird choice.
That was a really weird choice that never went anywhere.
Okay, here's the thing about Carrie Kelly. And it's something that I've talked about before. Carrie Kelly is the best part of Dark Knight Returns. Because the best panel in Dark Knight Returns is not Batman punching Superman with Gotham City. It's not You'll Stay Scared. It's not The Rain on My Chest is a Baptism. All that stuff's good. The best panels in Dark Knight Returns are when Batman asks Carrie Kelly what her name is. And she says, Carrie Kelly. And then she stops and looks at him and says, Robin. And that's the best fucking shit of all time. Like it does. Comics do not get better than those two panels. Comics do not get better than that. It's too fucking good.
It's pretty good. It is pretty good.
And also, what's great about that is that's everything you need to know about Carrie Kelly. You do not, like, that's her entire character is in there. She's great. Now, I have heard that there are, like, rumors that she appeared in two other miniseries.
Yeah.
But I discount those. Those are scurrilous and unfactual.
We can neither confirm nor deny that rumor. But we got to rank her. I think she's hurt by the fact that she's only in a very limited set of stories. She's a great design.
The glasses are so cool.
She has great Robin moments. The fact that in that one of those miniseries that we cannot confirm or deny, nor deny existing, that she weirdly turns into Catwoman?
Catgirl. Yeah.
Is a weird choice that I don't get.
Yeah.
So that might hurt her a little.
Yes, maybe a little bit. I think a lot of the characters that we have on the list, and this is something that we've got to really, like, get into as it goes on, sheer volume is going to help. You know, Spider-Man's been in 1,000 comics. Batman's been in fucking 2,000 comics.
Yeah.
You know, Doctor Doom has been in a lot of stories. The good and the bad, they filter out over time. Carrie Kelly's in War Rocket Ajax world, Carrie Kelly's in 4 comics.
Yeah.
And they're really, really good, but it's only 4 comics. She can only do, like, 4 really cool things, which she absolutely does.
And in that regard, I don't think I could put her above, like, Orphan.
It would be really hard for me to put her above the Ninja Turtles, you know?
Uh-huh.
Because they're really good and like, constant since, what, 85?
Weirdly, Miss Misery is comparable in a strange way, in that she only appears in a very finite number of issues. And you really have to judge her by her concept, her design, and the little bit of characterization you get in that brief, relatively brief story.
Yeah, which is all really good.
Yeah, I think there are more layers to Miss Misery, to be honest.
I don't know, man. I would put Carrie Kelly above Miss Misery.
Okay.
Orphan's the tough one, because I think she absolutely, like, the ceiling is Michelangelo, I think.
I think I'd put her below Orphan. I like Orphan better.
I mean, I like Orphan a lot, but, like, Orphan's also, you know, had some rough years.
Well, sure.
Then I guess Carrie Kelly had, uh-huh, too. Okay, under Orphan. There she goes.
All right, there she goes.
I convinced myself.
Thank you, Pedro, for that list. Those were some fun Robin strength. He said that Damian can go straight to hell. I disagree. I hope we get Damian.
Wow.
I hope we get Damian soon.
Yeah, Damian will go above at least half of that list.
Yeah, agreed. All right, that's going to do it for that panel president segment. If you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so by emailing us at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send every story ever lists, where you can send comments if you have them. If you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know at that email address. Visit our website, which is warrocketajax.com, to find show notes, a downloadable version of the show, streaming shows, and if you want to leave comments, check us out on iTunes as well. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, you'll find the show. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. The more positive reviews we get on iTunes, the more we are featured. And now, Chris, we have come to the part of the show where we tell you where you can find us on the internet. For me, just go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my books on Amazon. You'll find links to my Twitter and Tumblr. You can also check out my comic with Kevin Warren on Comixology, Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective. It's a fun time. Chris, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter and Tumblr as the ISB. That's THEISB. You can find me buying milk at the Durham Co-op sometimes. It's so good. Oh, local whole milk, so good. You can find my comics at comixology.com, where you can find Dracula the Unconquered and Radical Guardian Skater X and X-Men 92 out from Marvel. You can also find that one in print at your local comic book store. Next weekend, I'm going to be at Soda City Comic-Con in Columbia, South Carolina. That's right. I only made it 2 weeks before I went back to my home state. But I'll be there with Chad. We'll have X-Men 92s. If you happen to be in South Carolina, in the Columbia area, come to Soda City and see us. It'll be a fun time for everybody. Pick up X-Men 92. And I think that's about it. Comics Alliance, every day, Sailor Business, Movie Fighters when we do that on the monthly schedule now. That's where you can find me. Matt, am I forgetting anything?
If you did, we'll tell him next time.
That's right, everybody. This has been Work at Ajax, episode number 318. Remember, if you like the show, tell a friend. Tell them they might enjoy it if they're not already listening. Give them a Pranel President special to listen to. Those are fun. Have a good week, everybody. Good night. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Yeah! Flash.